It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Welcome. I'm Phil Picardi on this Tuesday, April 16. Today on the podcast, Minnesotans tell of their experiences at the Boston Marathon, House DFLers target cigarettes and alcohol for tax hikes, charges are coming against those who deal in walleye, and a top journalistic prize goes times two to a Minneapolis newspaper. First, hundreds of Minnesotans were registered for the Boston Marathon yesterday, and as Matt Sepik reports, some were just minutes past the finish line when the bombs went off.
Jay Quam was among the more than 500 Minnesotans who signed up to run the famous race. The Hennepin County judge crossed the finish line at Boston's Copley Square at 2:05 Eastern Time. He made his way through the crowd and walked a block or two to meet up with his family. Then, just after finding his wife and daughter, they heard an explosion, then another. Quam says he knew what it was immediately.
I thought that somebody must have planted some bombs at the finish line of the Boston Marathon, honestly. There really wasn't any other explanation for those distinctive sounds.
From his vantage point, Quam says there was palpable concern in the crowd, but not panic, and people moved away from the scene in an orderly way. He says as paramedics and police ran in, he and his fellow runners just walked away quickly. Quam says after running 26.2 miles, he probably wouldn't have been able to run anymore anyway, even if he had to.
And it's an odd situation where you got people, you know, kind of hobbling around after running a marathon. It's not like you can move super fast after that. But, you know, it was very orderly, moving away from where the explosions took place.
Other Minnesotans recount similar experiences. Maggie Tashney says she was a few hundred feet past the finish line when she heard the blasts.
It sounded like very loud thunder. It sounded like a cannon. It wasn't ear-piercing or anything, but something seemed wrong. It was pretty loud.
Ellen Gans, a runner from Edina, didn't hear anything. Gans says she was about 2 miles from the end when she found out what had happened.
You know, everyone's asking each other what's going on, and someone had said something about a bomb earlier, maybe 20 minutes before, but I think that everyone thought that it was just that someone had placed a bomb threat. So we were just all stopped, and there were several police officers standing around who told us that they were in the process of evacuating the finish and that we would not be able to continue the race.
Heather Walseth of Invergrove Heights was with a group of about 100 Minnesota runners organized by Lifetime Fitness. The company says all are accounted for and no one was hurt. Walseth crossed the finish line just 10 minutes before the bombs went off.
I was about maybe, I would say, a quarter of a mile away, and I heard the explosion. And initially my thought was, maybe that was thunder, and then I looked up and said, that's not possible, and then I looked towards the sound, which was at the finish, and I saw that there was smoke. When I looked, then I heard the second explosion, and then I realized that something was wrong, and quickly tried to get back to our hotel, which is about another quarter mile away. So I tried to walk as quickly as possible I could out of the area.
Walseth says it appears the bombers planned the attack for a time when there'd be the greatest number of spectators and runners at the finish line, about 4 hours into the race. Tobin Johnson of Plymouth finished in less than 3.5 hours and says he's extremely fortunate that he did.
Well, my wife and sister were standing right at that spot 45 minutes before. You know, if I hadn't run through the race that I did, they could have been right there.
Johnson says all three of them were safely back in their hotel when the bombs exploded, but they remain shaken by the attack, knowing that any one of them could have easily been in the wrong place at the wrong time.
NPR's Matt Sepik. The head of the Twin Cities Marathon says it's too early to know what the blasts might mean for Minnesota. Virginia Brophy Ackman says organizers put safety first, do crisis planning, and practice their response to emergency situations. She says it's important races continue.
You know, I think we'll have conversations, and I think obviously people will be doing their due diligence to be mindful of their surroundings, but I think, you know, we have to continue the things that we love and do.
The Twin Cities Marathon has about 12,000 runners this year. That will happen October 6th. Before that, Grandma's Marathon in Duluth will have about 10,000 participants. That runs June 22nd. Democrats in the Minnesota House are adding an alcohol tax to their list of tax increases to help balance the state's budget. Tom Scheck says the plan also includes a cigarette tax, an income tax hike for top earners, and higher taxes on corporations that operate overseas.
House Democrats have said before that they were going to raise income taxes on top earners and increase taxes on cigarettes to help balance the budget. This was the first time that they revealed that they are also targeting alcohol. DFL House Speaker Paul Thiessen says they want to raise taxes on alcohol and cigarettes because it would help offset state costs caused by smoking and drinking.
The reason we're going there is we believe that the costs associated with alcohol and tobacco hit the state budget and Minnesotans hard, and this is a way to address those issues.
The tax would vary based on the type of alcohol purchased. Spirits would see a $1.58 per bottle increase. Wine would be taxed an additional 47 cents a bottle. The tax on a 12-pack of beer would be 84 cents higher. Supporters of the higher tax on alcohol say it hasn't gone up for nearly 30 years. The Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association, which represents alcohol retailers, says the DFL plan would increase liquor taxes by 50%. The group's lobbyist, Joe Bagnoli, says his 2,200 members who own bars and liquor stores won't be able to afford the tax hike.
This is a regressive tax that is being applied to them at a time where they can least afford to absorb it. There's been increases in shipping, in food costs, in property taxes, and this is perhaps the most regressive way you can apply the tax and you can pass it on.
The House DFL tax plan would also create a new permanent fourth-tier income tax rate of 8.49% on couples with an annual taxable income of $400,000 a year or more. There is also a temporary income tax surcharge on couples with an annual taxable income of $500,000 or more that will pay back a K-12 school shift that was used to balance the budget in past years. That surcharge would end once the shift is paid back. The plan would also increase the tobacco tax by $1.60 per pack. Republican Representative Greg Davids of Preston was quick to criticize the DFL plan.
This proposal is a new chapter in DFL reality TV called Taxes Gone Wild. That's what we have here. And if this is a balanced approach, I would certainly hate to see an unbalanced approach.
The House DFL tax plan also provides property tax relief for 520,000 homeowners, increases the tax break for renters, and gives manufacturers a sales tax break for capital equipment purchases. It also helps pay for improvements in Rochester to handle a proposed Mayo Clinic expansion, for a Mall of America expansion, and a tax break for 3M. The House DFL tax bill raises a total of $2.6 billion over the next 2 years. DFL House Majority Leader Aaron Murphy says the new money is needed to end the state's budget roller coaster and spend more on education.
The revenue in the tax bill allows us to balance our deficit. It allows us to pay back our schools. And it allows us to invest in our future, an important future for everybody in Minnesota.
The plan still has to be reconciled with Senate Democrats and Governor Dayton. Dayton has said he does not support a tax on alcohol or the temporary income tax surcharge. His plan includes a higher permanent income tax rate on a larger number of Minnesotans. His tobacco tax is 66 cents per pack lower than House Democrats. Senate Democrats have yet to release their full tax bill, but a subcommittee report released last week includes a sales tax expansion on clothing and a host of consumer services while lowering the overall tax rate. Senate DFL leaders have also said their plan will include higher tobacco taxes and income taxes on top earners. They are expected to release their full plan next week.
Tom Scheck at the state capitol. He mentioned Democrats in the House have reduced the state's commitment on the proposed Mayo Clinic expansion plan. DFLers want Rochester to commit $128 million to the project, and they want Olmsted County to commit $119 million to build a transit line to help the expansion. DFL Representative Kim Norton of Rochester hopes the Mayo Clinic and local officials will support the proposal.
It's different, and some of it's going to be a challenge. I don't think there's, you know, any other way to say that. But the tax chair was really clear from the beginning that the locals are going to have more skin in the game, that that's how we do things here, that it's not free money.
Republican Representative Greg Davids of nearby Preston worries Rochester and Olmsted County are being asked for too much.
I don't want to put them in a position where they are not able to deliver. And I'm not saying they couldn't, but it seems like to go from $60 million to over $240 million is quite a stretch. Now, that's what's been proposed today, and hopefully we can work that number back for the city and the county.
The Mayo Clinic had asked the state for more than $500 million in improvements as part of its Rochester expansion plan. An influential House member is proposing legislation targeting administrative pay at state colleges. Alex Friedrich has more.
The proposal would require both Minsky and the University of Minnesota to more fully report how they spend money on administration. Minsky would also have to make up for future shortfalls in labor or programs by slashing administration instead of by cutting programs or raising tuition and fees. Higher Education Committee Chairman Gene Pawlowski, a DFLer from Winona, says the requirements are not just a fix for this session.
I want to do it long term. I want to do it consistently. And I want to make sure they're held accountable with any budget they bring to this legislature.
Another proposal in the bill would restrict, if not eliminate, the ability of Minsky and the U to issue bonuses to administrators.
Alex Friedrich there. Now Curtis Gilbert. He says Minneapolis DFLers take the first step in choosing a candidate for mayor tonight.
The DFL holds 117 precinct caucuses at sites around the city starting at 7 tonight. Anyone who supports the party and will be eligible to vote in city elections this November can participate. The main order of business will be to elect delegates to the city convention this June. Those delegates will decide which, if any, of the mayoral candidates to endorse. Candidates Betsy Hodges, Gary Schiff, Don Samuels, Jackie Cherryholmes, and Mark Andrew have been working to turn out their supporters to the caucuses. As a result, party officials say they're preparing for relatively heavy turnout, especially in parts of the city that also have competitive city council races. In addition to city convention delegates, caucus-goers will also elect delegates to the ward conventions happening over the course of the next month. Those delegates will decide who to endorse for city council.
Curtis Gilbert on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. State DNR officials say a three-year investigation will result in charges against nearly two dozen people who allegedly sold or purchased walleye illegally in northern Minnesota. Tom Robertson reports the charges come on the heels of similar federal indictments filed against 10 people last week.
21 people in six counties across north-central and northwestern Minnesota will face state charges. More are expected to face charges in tribal court on the Red Lake and Leech Lake Indian reservations. DNR Commissioner Tom Landwehr says the charges involve both illegal purchases and sales of walleye taken from some of Minnesota's most popular fishing lakes, including Cass, Leech, Red, and Winnebogoshish lakes located on the two reservations.
It hurts all of the legal anglers and netters in the state by taking the resource away from them. And for that, people ought not tolerate that sort of culture of acceptability. And if you engage in this type of illegal activity, at some point we will catch you.
Authorities say the suspects allegedly bought and sold tens of thousands of walleye. County attorneys will pursue state charges in Beltrami, Clearwater, Cass, Polk, Pennington, and Itasca counties. Jim Conrad is director of the DNR's Enforcement Division. Conrad says DNR officers documented the suspects buying and selling tens of thousands of walleye. They allege some of the suspects also threw away hundreds of northern pike and other fish because they weren't as highly prized as walleye. Conrad says buying and selling walleye on the black market will likely continue even after this latest enforcement effort.
Certainly, we didn't catch everybody who's involved in purchasing or selling fish. So we did as much as we could, but certainly we believe that there's a lot more of that activity going out there.
Conrad says investigators found no evidence that illegal walleye were sold to restaurants or taverns. He says sellers often sold their fish informally at bars and through local contacts.
The investigation revealed widespread acceptance of illegal purchase of fish as a cultural norm. With investigations like this that target the purchaser as well as the supplier, we hope to change this culture. Until people stop buying illegal fish, the suppliers will continue to catch and sell them.
In addition to the new charges against 21 non-tribal members, 10 tribal members were indicted by federal authorities last week. Red Lake and Leech Lake authorities say they'll pursue charges against additional tribal members in tribal court. This is Minnesota's largest investigation of black market fish sales since the early 1990s, when 45 Minnesotans were charged with illegally selling fish from the Red Lake and Leech Lake reservations. It was that black market activity and over-harvesting that led to the collapse of the walleye population on the upper and lower Red Lakes. The walleye have since recovered thanks to state and tribal restocking efforts. Red Lake Tribal Chairman Floyd Buck Jourdain says since the walleye recovery, most tribal members have been very protective of their walleye resource. But Jourdain says there have always been those who try to make money off of selling the fish illegally.
There was a concern with the resurgence of the walleye that at some point there would be also a resurgence in the black market. And that's something that we here at Red Lake feel is a grave injustice to all band members. When people go out and commit these kind of crimes against the Red Lake people, then you know we're glad that they're being held to account.
Many of the suspects face a maximum $3,000 fine, and they could spend up to a year in jail.
That's Tom Robertson in Bemidji. Cleanup efforts continue today on a manure spill at a dairy farm in Fillmore County. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency believes 1 million gallons spilled into a ditch Sunday night when a concrete wall gave way. Some of the spill reached a creek and some reached a trout stream. Mike Frownkrown, the county's feedlot officer, says crews have contained about three-quarters of the spill.
We put boards in front of the culvert so it can't get any farther. What has gotten into the intermittent stream where there's actually snowmelt and rainfall runoff right now, there's nothing we can do with that. It's never good news that we have a spill, but it's good news that we can at least contain it and get it cleaned up.
What remains in the pit is being pumped out and spread on nearby farm fields. Despite reaching a tentative agreement with musicians last week, management of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra has canceled 2 more weeks of concerts. Here's Ewan Kerr.
Interim SPCO President Dobson West announced the cancellations in a message to SPCO supporters. He said last week's tentative local agreement is dependent in part on reaching an agreement with the National American Federation of Musicians on broadcast and internet rights. He says talks continue with the AFM, but they have not reached an agreement yet. As a result, concerts are now cancelled through May 5th. West says he hopes these will be the last concert cancellations. A representative of the SPCO musicians said the cancellations were disappointing, but not unexpected.
Ewan Kerr in St. Paul. The 2013-2014 Guthrie Theater season contains everything from Shakespeare to cutting-edge contemporary drama. Artistic director Joe Dowling says it includes classics such as the musical My Fair Lady.
Beautiful, beautiful music by Lerner and Lowe, but also a classically based text. So it's, I think, a perfect combination for a Guthrie presentation. So I'm really looking forward to that.
The Guthrie season also includes works by Minnesota artists. Minneapolis-based director Marion McClinton will direct Othello, and Penumbra Theater will present The Mountaintop. The Star Tribune is on the mountaintop of sorts. It's celebrating after winning 2 Pulitzer Prizes. The awards were for local reporting and editorial cartooning. Martin Moylan says the prizes were the first for the paper since 1990.
Steve Sack had been drawing cartoons for the Star Tribune for quite a while.
Over 32 years, I think it is, I've drawn over 7,500.
And he didn't think he'd win a Pulitzer, but 20 of the cartoons he created last year were good enough to win journalism's highest prize, much to Sack's surprise.
I thought my boss was joking when he came in and told me. I thought he was messing with me. But it took a while to sink in.
Sack says reader reactions guided the selection of cartoons he submitted. Many needled politicians, such as Vice President Joe Biden. Sack drew the mind of Biden as a bumper car banging around the inside of the vice president's head.
Well, it was an election year, so there were a lot of political characters running for president. Other than that, it's just whatever happened to be in the news that piqued my interest and deserved a cartoon.
But Sack also skewered public figures such as Lance Armstrong, putting the former bicycling champion on a bike that had its wheel spokes replaced with syringes. The Strib's other Pulitzer went to reporters Brad Schrade, Jeremy Olson, and editor Glenn Howitt. They won in the local reporting category for a series on a spike in infant deaths at Minnesota's home daycare facilities. Schrade and his collaborators spent about 8 months on the series. Schrade said they examined hundreds of public records and found that the number of children dying in child care had nearly doubled over 5 years, reaching the rate of one per month.
I'm glad that we were able to spend the time digging into it and had a positive impact on an important issue for Minnesota.
Most of the deaths involved sleeping children. The newspaper's investigation found a lack of training on how to position infants so they would sleep safely. Schrade said the series resulted in legislative action to strengthen the oversight of home daycare businesses and changed how infants are cared for by in-home daycare providers.
We just had a story a week or two ago about how the death rate has dramatically declined in the last 8 or 9 months since we started reporting on this. We helped bring this issue to light, and regulators and the public really got on top of this issue.
Each Pulitzer comes with $10,000. Star Tribune editor Nancy Barnes said she was thrilled for her newsroom.
Individually, prizes don't matter that much, but I'm really grateful for the recognition of all the hard work we're doing. The daycare package that won, they saved some lives, and that's just great. And then, of course, you have our cartoonist who's been toiling away at a craft for decades, and it's just thrilling for him to be able to win, too.
It's unusual for a paper of the Star Tribune size to win two Pulitzers in 1 year. Typically, only the nation's biggest daily papers pull that off. Jim Romanesco is a longtime media observer.
I was very surprised to see that the Star Tribune came down with two Pulitzers. As long as I've been watching Pulitzers, which is decades, I don't recall a paper of the Star Tribune's size winning two Pulitzers in 1 year. It really is a great feat for them.
The newspaper had previously won two Pulitzer Prizes, one in 1990 for investigative reporting and the other in 1959 for photography.
That's Martin Moylan on the NPR News Update. We close out the podcast checking in with Michael Olson. He is the editor of Minnesota Today and today's question at nprnews.org. Michael, the Boston Marathon bombing's getting the most headlines across the state.
Participants are coming from all over, you know, the world, but also all over Minnesota, not just the Twin Cities. But you're seeing, you know, many of the smaller papers have checked in with folks that were there or participating. And so far, I haven't seen anybody, and I've read dozens of accounts from around the state of people that were expressing, you know, just their recounting the fear and the whole, I guess, the trauma and the shock associated with it. But thankfully, so far, I'm not coming across anything that talks about someone who is injured.
Right. And, of course, moving forward, I guess you'll have folks from Duluth, Grandma's Marathon, and here in the Twin Cities Marathon, trying to figure out what they're going to be doing with their security going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're looking into what they're going to do. And I'm actually going to be posting a question here that people, as you're listening to the podcast, you can jump over onto today's question, and we'll ask folks, you know, does this, you know, we won't be focusing exclusively on marathons. It doesn't seem that that is the reason that it was the target,
right?
Perhaps. We don't know why it is a target, but just in general, large public gatherings, if this changes their resolve, whether it's they're concerned about participating or going to these things, or does it make them more determined, which we saw a mix of that response after the attacks on 9/11.
And that's today's question at nprnews.org. What else is happening in Minnesota today?
Well, you know, the big story that we had on there this morning was an item about this massive cow manure spill. The far southeastern corner of the state, it's the Root River, and it's actually has gone into tributaries of the Root River, and it's estimated at least 1 million gallons of manure broke through a concrete-walled pit. And so it's a big problem there. It's the tributary is a great trout stream. A million gallons of manure can't be good for that. And it's also some a place where the Minnesota DNR is listed on one of our many water trails as kind of a treasure. So it's the tributaries that feed into the Root River, which then feeds into the Mississippi River.
So anything else going on in Minnesota today we should know about?
Well, yeah, you know, we're always keeping up with the news of the day there. We have, there's a video posted of some spring kayaking in Minnesota, which is a good way to spend 30 seconds of your day today, where you see a man in his canoe, or his kayak rather, and he's starting off into the sliding across the snow and then into what appears to be a pooled pond in his backyard where he can kind of splash around there. It's kind of funny. But we have a lot of items on just people really reaching their breaking point with this weather. It seems like this last weekend kind of was the tipping point for a lot of folks, especially with the larger storm that we had late last week, and then what's coming up here tomorrow, too.
Yeah, more snow Wednesday into Thursday, some snow in the forecast, I think, for Sunday as well.
Yeah.
So, and that's even reaches into the Twin Cities, not accumulating snow, but a wintry mix, and it's, what, April 16th, so it's time for it to end.
It is, and it's fun to see people react to this. I've posted up a couple things, a couple questions about how people are dealing with it, or what's the best part of it, the worst part, and it's, you can tell that Minnesotans are very conflicted about this. One, because we're supposed to be a hardy
bunch.
Gotta
be tough, right?
You gotta be tough.
Yeah.
But you know that we haven't seen an intense snowstorm like the one we saw last week. We haven't seen that in the state in at least a decade. So it isn't as if we just turned into a bunch of pansies. You know, that could be part of the deal, as especially if you look at what a beautiful spring, or unseasonably warm spring, we had last year. Maybe that did you know, corrupt our good character here, but it's a lively discussion that's going on there.
All right. Well, thank you, Michael.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That's Michael Olson, editor of Minnesota Today, and Today's Question, both found at mprnews.org. And this is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule, Wednesday news on your schedule right here tomorrow. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for joining me today.